Welcome to the Apria Podcast Series. Today, we bring you a new episode of the Apria Podcast Series. In this episode, we chat with Rushabh Desai, Chief Executive Officer, Asia Pacific of Alliance Real Estate. Based in Singapore, Rushabh will highlight the art of balancing life and the business, how to think outside the box, and what he did before he became a CEO. Join us today to listen to how leaders in real estate are navigating the unprecedented uncertainties of 2020 and what Rushabh's thoughts are on the foreseeable future.
This is the Apria Podcast with Mark Cooper. Today, I'm with Rushabh Desai, who's CEO Asia Pacific at Allianz Real Estate. Welcome, Rush.
Thank you, Mark. Good morning. I'm very happy to be part of this podcast.
Fantastic. We're going to start, as usual, with a little bit of personal stuff, a bit of your background, and then move on to the Allianz business and your thoughts of the market around Asia Pacific. Now, I did a little bit of LinkedIn stalking of you and saw that your very first job, or the first job on there, was as a business analyst in a cocoa distributors. Tell us a bit about that and how you got from there to where you are today.
Thank you, Mark. This is the first time in my career someone has asked me about cocoa distributors, but I'm happy to share the story. So my family back in Kolkata, India, has a small trading business called Cocoa Distributors. My first job assigned by my father was a training in that family business. And he told me there was one simple objective: to appreciate the efforts required at the grassroots levels to make a business successful. And then the day I was leaving for my first day at General Electric Company, my father, who was a very simple man and a small businessman, asked me to remember one thing. And he said, look, it is okay to be less successful than others, but it is not okay to be less successful than you think you can be. And this sort of has become my guiding principle. To me, being successful is to exceed your own expectations. And throughout my career, in fact, each working day, I set out my ambitions and then roll up my sleeves to try and achieve those ambitions and try to exceed those ambitions. Tenacity, I think, is what gets me through the day. And the genesis of all this is my small stint at my family business, Cocoa Distributors, at the beginning of my career.
Excellent. And very good advice from your father.
Thank you.
And where did you go next? So you spent quite a while with GE. Tell us a bit about that and the move into real estate.
Yeah, look, I joined General Electric Company back in India in 2003, it was. And I joined GE's finance program, leadership program. GE is very well known to have one of the best finance leadership programs across the globe. And so I was fortunate to be part of that finance leadership program. I went through the leadership program for about six and a half years. And had the opportunity to travel the world, be part of different GE businesses, both on the industrial side as well as the financial services side, and learn the ropes of the business from a finance point of view. And being a public company, you know, finance plays an important role in companies like GE. And that sort of was a terrific experience. I think the foundations of my career, having the opportunity to see so many different businesses, meet so many different people all over the world, and learn about different things. At the end of that leadership program, I took up an opportunity to join GE's real estate business in Asia Pacific. This was in early 2009. When the impact of the global financial crisis had just started to come in. And it was an opportunity to be part of a business which was going to go through a cyclical correction and see what it means, because it is sort of, it was rare to be in GE and be part of a business that wasn't doing well. And this was my opportunity. And again, it turned out to be one of the big learning experiences, because real estate during that crisis had a significant impact on the valuations and how everybody had to navigate through that crisis. And so I spent from 2009 until my exit in 2015 at GE's real estate business in Asia Pacific. different roles. I was initially the strategy person responsible for navigating the business through the crisis. Then I became the chief financial officer of the business. The business was spanned across Asia Pacific, headquartered in Japan, with about 12 billion of equity in the region, both across equity and debt investments. So it was my introduction to real estate at the most opportune time in terms of learning experiences. And then coming out of that, again, crisis, I saw very closely what are the things to do and not to do during a crisis like this, and how to navigate the business through uncertainty. And again, that has been very helpful in the current times. And then from GE, I spent a little amount of time at Lone Star Funds in Japan before moving to the current role in Allianz Real Estate.
Okay, Allianz. And working, so you had a couple of stints now working for François Schwarz at Allianz and previously at GE.
Yes, indeed. François Schwarz was the Asia Pacific CEO at GE's real estate business, and I spent a considerable amount of time in that business in different roles, working closely with François Schwarz. And then at Allianz Real Estate, he is the global CEO. So I still work for François Krauch.
Good. Okay. Now you mentioned that you were working in Tokyo then, and obviously you're in Singapore now, originating in Kolkata. So you've lived and worked around the world a fair bit, and obviously you, as a consequence of the nature of your role now, until recent times, you would be doing a fair bit of travel. Tell us, what's your favourite city? What would be your favourite city to live and work in? And it doesn't necessarily have to be somewhere that you've actually lived before. What makes the ideal city for you?
Look, I would have a split response to that. Tokyo in Japan, I must say, is one of my absolute favorite cities to live. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, it is one of the most vibrant 24/7 global cities. And on the other hand, it still has retained its traditions and culture. It amazes me how the modernization and culture have successfully coexisted in Japan, and it continues to be so even today. And so it is just an absolute, it's a lot of fun to live in a place like this where you have sort of two different dynamics playing at the same time. On the other hand, you know, living in Singapore has been fairly positive. Singapore is one of the easiest places to live in this region. It is easily accessible, ease of doing business, and fairly diverse set of people who live in Singapore. So I think from that perspective, Singapore is one of the most efficient places to live and work, and I quite enjoy living here now. But whenever I get a chance, I do love to go back to Tokyo. I'm happy that just before the travel ban and crisis, I spent a couple of weeks in Japan. So at least I could do my annual family trips to Japan this year.
Ah, great, great. And how, in normal times, how often are you traveling around the region, and to which places are you typically traveling?
I think if my wife were to listen to this answer, she would disagree. But I try to travel 5 to 10 days a month, and try to restrict it to 5 if I can. But sometimes it's more than 5. But I try to travel 5 to 10 days in the month, and my trips, a lot of it is in the region, going to the different parts of the region where we do investments. So China plays a big part in that, Japan, Australia, India for that matter, Hong Kong, Korea. We haven't made many investments there, but I've been visiting regularly. So it's sort of all across the region, and then on a regular basis, at least once a quarter, if not more, I do visit Europe. A lot of it is in Munich, where it is our headquarters, but it's also other cities in Europe that I visit for business reasons. And then my trips to US have cut down relative to my previous job, but I still get to visit US. Maybe once a year, we do get together in the US for our executive committee meetings once in a while, and that is an opportunity for me to go there. Now, it is important for me to travel outside of Asia because I do sit on the Global Investment Committee. So for me to be able to make proper decisions, it is important to me for me to keep up to date with the markets. You know, doing things remotely has its challenges when it comes to such decision making. So I think it is very helpful to go to a particular city or a country and spend time with the local Allianz real estate teams, understand their views on the market, meet some external participants and get their views as well. And so that the decision we make at the Global Investment Committee are well-informed decisions. So I think it's incredibly useful and important for all of us at the investment committee level to be able to travel into each other's region.
Yeah. Okay. Now you said you try to kind of, if at all possible, to keep your work travel down to 5 days a month or 5 to 10 days a month. That's obviously part of trying to kind of get some sort of work-life balance. What else do you do to try and achieve that? Assuming that it's really feasible in a senior role such as yours to have a work-life balance. So what do you do and what would you advise others to do?
Look, for me, work-life balance means going about my day in a manner which allows me to go to bed with a positive mind frame and wake up next morning with a positive outlook. And sometimes this means spending more time at work. And sometimes this means spending more time with my wife, Shruti, and my two-year-old daughter, Aishi. So work-life balance means different things to different people. So it is difficult to recommend a cookie-cutter approach to anyone. However, the one thing that has worked for me is to be able to find just 15 to 30 minutes every day for myself. And this is purely for myself, away from work, away from friends, away from family, keeping my phone at home, and I just go out for a quiet stroll or a walk early in the morning or late at night. And this really helps me clear my mind and puts a lot of things in perspective, both the work as well as personal. And I started doing this about 2 years ago, and I have made sure that I try to follow as much as possible, weather permitting. And the important part is to leave your phone back at home. So there's no temptation to check messages and emails. And I think that sort of has really been one of the things that I do to sort of ensure that I get some time for myself.
Okay, yeah, good. That little bit of off time. Great. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about Allianz. It's a well-established organization. Give us a kind of two-minute introduction to it globally. And then, obviously, as it's relatively new to Asia-Pacific, tell us a bit about how you go about establishing the team portfolio and business here.
As of today, Allianz Real Estate is the captive real estate investment manager for the Allianz Group. We serve over 38 Allianz clients. So these are different Allianz businesses which are investing in real estate. Today, as of last year, end of last year, we had about $82 billion plus of assets under management with about 20 plus offices across the globe and about 500 plus people globally in these offices. So it is a truly global, diversified investment powerhouse in the real estate space. The most fun part about my job at Allianz Real Estate has been building the business in Asia Pacific. We've gone from about 500 million exposure and two people in 2016 to about 6 billion exposure and 30 people across three offices in about 3.5 years. So it has been a very exciting 3.5 years working at Allianz Real Estate. The first and foremost thing for me was to understand what attracted Allianz to Asia Pacific and then formulate a long-term strategic framework to achieve these objectives. And the three things that came across as benefits of having exposure to Asia Pacific were it provides portfolio diversification to Allianz. It also provides Allianz an opportunity to secure long-term secular growth, which is occurring in Asia Pacific. It also gives Allianz the ability to match local assets with local liabilities, which is important for an insurance company. And one of the things coming out of this current crisis is also the fact that if you have a portfolio in a region which is also diversified within the region, that makes the portfolio more resilient. For example, a China is very different from an Australia, very different from an India and a Singapore. We are seeing that today, even with how the crisis is being managed or the pandemic is being managed. And if you have a diversified portfolio, all your eggs are not in one basket, even within a region. So I think, you know, you have that added diversification when you're investing in Asia Pacific, because each market is operating at a different pace. And then, you know, next it was, apart from setting up the strategic framework, it was very important to establish credibility, both externally as well as internally. And credibility comes over time and through successes and failures that we've had. Today, I'm very proud of the fact that Allianz Real Estate is considered as one of the most credible investors in the Asia-Pacific region. And last but not the least, it is incredibly important for me to build the right infrastructure. Now that the setup is fully localized, we have 30 people across Singapore, Tokyo, and Shanghai. All 29 of them have been handpicked by me, so I will take full responsibility if any one of them is unable to uphold the Allianz values. So we sink and swim together in that sense. I think we have a terrific team, one that knows how to navigate efficiently to get to the finishing line ahead of their own expectations. And we are seeing that in the current crisis, how the team is operating and able to do transactions and manage the portfolio.
Okay, just to go back to one point, you mentioned it's important to establish Allianz as a credible force in Asia Pac. How do you do that? What's your what do you do to establish your credibility?
I think, look, it starts with the strategic framework that I spoke about, I think, and the credibility has to be internal as well as externally. So I think having that strategic framework and clear goals as to what are we trying to achieve in this market versus trying to look at every opportunity and everything that comes our way. So we have a very clear strategic framework on what we think we want to invest in and what we think we would try to avoid. And that has been a clear and consistent message to the market. And the market has now clearly understood. Secondly, I think when we get into a conversation or a discussion with a counterparty, it is important that we are able to deliver on what we are committing. And so, one, we have to be careful on what we commit. However, before I commit to something in the market, I make sure that I have the buy-in of the broader Allianz Real Estate and the Allianz Group. And then, you know, we made sure that once we made those commitments, we have met those commitments, and be it closing a deal during such a crisis or, you know, delivering something that we had promised our tenants and making sure we uphold that commitment. So I think that staying on course with your commitment and making sure you deliver that is on a consistent basis has helped us build credibility in this market.
Okay. And you mentioned making sure that you're sort of in line with sort of Allianz HQ. How involved are they, and how much sort of day-to-day dealings do you have with headquarters in Munich?
Sure. As I mentioned earlier, I'm fortunate to be part of the Allianz Real Estate Global Executive Committee as well as the Global Investment Committee. So this allows all of us who are part of it to have constant exchange of ideas and information. So we get together at least once a week, typically on an average twice a week. And during this current crisis, it's more than twice a week. So additionally, at Allianz Real Estate, there is a fairly open working style where if you need something, you pick up the phone and call the other person. So it's a fairly seamless process and culture that is out there. So operating in Asia Pacific with the headquarters in Munich has never been an issue. My simple rule with regards to investment and partnership is not to catch anyone off guard. So we do spend a lot of time to build grounds for a consensus-driven decision-making. And that is something that it is a strength of Allianz, that decision-making is based on consensus. And of course, it requires appropriate levels of communication between the two sides. But I think so far it has been seamless, and and Munich, our headquarters, have been on board on everything we've done so far. And one of the good things, again, I go back to it, is establishing the long-term strategic framework and then operating within that framework. Thereby, sort of, you have that credibility within the organization that there is a plan and we are implementing that plan.
Okay. Tell us a bit more about the investment side. You've obviously done a number of partnerships already in this region. What do you look for in an investment partner?
Thank you. That's an interesting question. I think the one word that immediately comes to my mind is trust. We believe in building long-term scalable relationships, and you've seen that in this region. We've built up a scalable relationship with the likes of Charter Hall, God Capital, and others in the market. And this trust requires that both parties are honest with each other. We want to be able to trust our partner's expertise. We want to be able to trust that they will always act in the best interest of our partnership. One of the most recent example of this trust is the announcement of the joint venture to acquire the RD distribution centers in Australia, where we were unable to travel to Australia due to COVID-19 and were not able to complete our site visits. However, this did not stop us from completing the transaction, as we were able to leverage our longstanding partner, Charter Hall, to conduct the on-the-ground due diligence on our behalf. They understand our requirements because we've been working with them. We trust their judgment and assessment, and that enabled us to come together to acquire this portfolio despite the challenges around the travel. So I think, you know, trust is a very important thing for us. And then once you have the trust, building scalable relationships with our partners has been one of the pillars of our success.
And that trust, is that something that you have is on a sort of an organization to an organization basis, that you know that your partner has similar values to Allianz? Or is it more about your personal relationship with the person leading that company or leading the partnership?
Look, the relationships are institutional. So our partners get to interact with our global team. Sometimes we bring our partners to other parts of the world. Sometimes when our executive committee members and investment committee members are in this part of the world, we introduce them to our partners and let them spend time with each other. And that also allows us to generate opportunities outside of one particular region. And that is useful for both sides to learn from each other. So the relationships are institutional, but of course those are helped by individuals within the organization. Individuals build those relationships and try to sort of institutionalize those relationships. A lot of it is you've got to start somewhere, so an individual had to start that relationship, and then I think we have an incredible model of institutionalizing these relationships on a global basis, and we've seen that with most of our relationships, where it's very well connected across the globe. And a lot of these relationships are with global players. So I think both sides benefit a lot from each other.
Okay, great. And just on the investments, what sort of risk-return profile do you target for Asia real estate investments? And is that different at all to what you're looking for the rest of the world?
Sure. Look, being a global business, we have the benefit of comparing opportunities across the globe and pursue the ones which are the most attractive on a risk-adjusted basis. Now, to be able to compare opportunities on a global basis, they have to be denominated in the same currency, for example, and those have to be evaluated using some basic global underwriting standards. Otherwise, the comparison is flawed. So we have those processes and standards in place, which allows us to make a comparison on a global basis. Return expectations are benchmarked to the local markets, where multiple factors like bond yields, money cost, foreign exchange rates, etc., come into play. So there isn't one global return hurdle. I think we look at opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis and then compare it to what is the return expectation of other product investment opportunities in the local market, and then evaluate those opportunities. Now, Allianz Real Estate is a disciplined core long institutional investor. Our long-term goal is to have 80% of our portfolio comprising of core income-producing investments and about 20% of the portfolio in value-add and opportunistic investment, allowing us to tactically participate in market dislocation or arbitrage opportunities. So our team in the region is fully equipped to serve both these core as well as value-add opportunistic investment requirements. And globally, we bring up these opportunities every Monday. There is an investment committee call. And on an average, we go through 3 to 5 deals every Monday, and allows us to compare and contrast and then pursue opportunities which we feel are the best suited for our Allianz investors.
Okay. Moving on to sort of thinking a bit more about the market and what's going on at the moment. One of the things that that we've noticed is that the news everywhere is overwhelmed by the coronavirus. Does that make it more difficult for you to find out what's going on in the real estate markets? Where do you look for information, first of all?
You're right. There is a lot of information flowing around on COVID-19, and a lot of it sometimes conflicts with each other. You know, you read a piece of information in the morning, there's a different opinion in the evening. So I think we've gotten to a point where I rely a lot on information coming out of the Allianz as a group, as well as the Allianz real estate research team. And we have very, very credible and solid research team, both at the Allianz level and at the Allianz real estate level. So I look for the facts coming out of that, these research reports, which come out very regularly, at least once a week, and look for facts and information there. But look, COVID-19 is more of a social and psychological crisis rather than a financial crisis, which of course any crisis will have an impact on the economy. But this is different from the previous crisis in our minds. So I try to speak to as many people as possible and seek their opinion on how the pandemic is affecting their day-to-day lives. And it is interesting how the views differ between, for example, a 30-year-old single person versus someone with 2-3-year-old kids or 70-year-old parents. It differs drastically between someone who's living in a one-room studio in Tokyo versus someone living in a big house in California or Hamptons. The crisis is certainly going to change how we live and work in the future. But I feel the exact nature of these changes can only be known once we return to a steady, normal state. A lot of the responses today could be out of fear, frustration, and uncertainty, which people react differently to such such uncertainty. However, you know, what is clear is that the crisis has accelerated some of the long-term mega trends, especially in the Asia-Pacific region. Digitization, for example. There couldn't have been a faster and a better way to adopt technology the way people have adopted in the last 5 months. Okay, so clearly, it needed a virus to help us adopt technology faster, and that's the reality of the situation. Decentralization and localization. This crisis has clearly shown, you know, businesses need to be decentralized. The hub and spoke model is a very useful model. There needs to be local people in your local teams, and we have seen the benefit of having an office in Japanese guy in our Japanese office, in our Tokyo office. We could close a deal last month because we had a Japanese person on the ground who went and could do everything despite the fact that we were in a closed down phase in Singapore. Infrastructure spend, you know, with the government trying to come up with fiscal measures, I think a lot of the infrastructure spending is going to get accelerated, which is a good thing for Asia-Pacific markets. Domestic consumption, again, the governments are trying very hard to ensure they prop up domestic consumption. And again, this is one of the mega trends, the increase in domestic consumption in big economies like China and India. And this is just getting accelerated due to this crisis. So there are certain benefits of this crisis. Every crisis has its pluses and minuses. The benefits here is that some of the long-term mega trends have got accelerated due to the current uncertainty.
Okay, and does the acceleration of those trends mean anything different for your investment strategy at the moment? I mean, obviously, I agree with what you're saying that you have to really wait until everything is quietened down, for want of a better phrase, before you can really look at the long term. But has there been anything, you know, if you think about sectors like retail or hospitality, anything that's kind of changed your thinking about those for the longer term?
Look, successful businesses are the ones which are able to quickly adapt. So I think every business has now got to adapt to that, to the new normal or the new situation that is confronting us. For us at Allianz Real Estate, what it means is a couple of things. We want to be more disciplined than ever in our investments, and both in terms of the types of investments we pursue, and the underwriting that we come up with for these investment business plans that we come up with has to be much more realistic, factoring in a scenario where the recovery is a longer-term recovery. So discipline is the first and foremost thing that sort of increased discipline is something that we have brought about. Downside protection, you know, investing in Asia Pacific, the view still is that on a long-term basis, Asia Pacific, the attractiveness of this region hasn't gone away. However, in the near term, there seems to be some material changes in terms of the growth prospects. And so when you are investing in or buying something new or coming up with a business plan, it's really important that we factor in the near term contingencies in the near term and have adequate downside protection to be able to ride through the crisis. And one of the things I tell my team is when they bring an investment opportunity, I asked them, I said, look, let's take an example. You're underwriting, if I were to cut your first 3 years NOI by 50% or 20% or 30%, would the investment still be attractive and would you still want us to invest in it? And that sort of is the mindset that the team is asked to have when they're looking at new investment. And if it does still stand attractive despite any sort of haircut you have in the near term, that it does mean that it's an attractive opportunity for long-term investment, which is what we want to do, and then we will pursue those investments. Then obviously we want to take advantage of the dislocation opportunities. There are a few in this region, we haven't seen many. The public markets moved up quite a bit, though last night there was a correction. But I think if and when the dislocation opportunities arises, we want to be able to take advantage of this dislocation opportunities. And then last but not the least, we want to continue to be a diversified investor in the Asia Pacific region. And by diversification, I mean that we want to be able to partner with other people and do joint ventures and club deals and other types of structures, which allows us to diversify our capital across more investment than a fewer investment. That doesn't mean we wouldn't do direct investment. We would do that as well. But I think diversification in terms of approach is also something which is important for us. And one of the things that we have realized is that, you know, we are one of the few core institutional investors which has a large presence on the ground. And now we have very good credibility here in the Asia Pacific region. So we would be open to exploring invest alongside Allianz. Investors who would like to invest in the region, who may or may not have the resources and the infrastructure, however, are like-minded investors to Allianz, then we would welcome sort of such investors to invest alongside Allianz, and they can benefit from our infrastructure and our discipline and our oversight in making these investments in these regions. So I think that will be another way to sort of expand that diversification approach versus just doing joint ventures and clubs. It is to look at opportunities for other investors to invest alongside Allianz.
Okay. You said, which I thought was a really good point, that the current crisis is sort of social and psychological rather than financial. So bearing that in mind, how has it affected the sort of the day-to-day business logistics for Allianz Real Estate in the region? What have you done to kind of to help your teams in the three different cities kind of keep together and keep going and, you know, keep positive?
Sure. Look, we have Allianz as a global business continuity management group, and then every business has its own BCM M group, and in Asia Pacific, it's headed by myself and my head of HR. And what we do is we come up with consistent and frequent guidelines for the teams to guide them on do's and don'ts in this crisis. And these guidelines are aligned to the local government measures as well as are aligned to the Allianz broader Allianz guidelines. We have other Allianz businesses in every part of the world, so we also talk to them and make sure that there is a consistent approach to all Allianz employees within a region. However, currently the situation on the ground is different by country, and today China is fully operational. People are able to move around domestically, so my team is able to conduct a site visit. Japan, you are able to move around within a prefecture without any restrictions. From 20th of June, I think you can move around even domestically within Japan. So that is sort of at a different phase. And then Singapore is obviously in a slightly different phase where it's still work from home. So every country has their own nuances, and then we try to adopt to the local regulations as well as Allianz guidelines. However, you know, to keep the team together and ensure that we all operate as a team, we have very regular calls on the video and interaction, and everybody comes on the video, everybody is sort of dressed up as if they are going to work. And I think it sort of gives people a sense of pride to be able to be dressed up and seeing it, as if they're at work. We talk with each other. There's a lot of messaging and social media forums, and we pick up the phone and talk to each other as much as we can. And the video has really helped, and I sort of do it as a, I do it every day with one part of the business or one team within the business. And one day it's the acquisition team, the other day is the asset management team. And it's sort of a bit of both personal and professional discussion. And so that people feel connected. And, you know, unfortunately, I can't sort of take them out for a coffee, but I think where I would have had some personal chats as well with people and their families and get to know them better. So I try to do that over the video. When we have some new people joining, it's a bit challenging for new people to assimilate into an organization remotely. However, so far we haven't had any issues because the level of interaction and everybody's been encouraged to do video calls and versus just doing phone calls. I think that has so far been okay, and people are still sort of connected and have figured out ways to work with each other.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about some of the sectors and markets that you're invested in Asia Pacific. So logistics, an important growing sector around the world and developing rapidly here in Asia Pac, and it's something that you've invested in. What appeals most about it, and where do you see its longer term future going?
Sure. Before I get into logistics specifically, look, I 3 years ago when we started investing in the region, we said we want to align our investment to secular mega trends. And we have stayed on course with that. And that has really helped us, because today, if you look at our portfolio, there's probably a third is office, a third is logistics, about 15% residential for rent, a bit of student housing, and a bit of exposure to outlet malls and some exposure to retail in Hong Kong. So the portfolio in Asia Pacific is turning out to be relatively resilient vis-a-vis, you know, what I'm hearing from some other investors. So we're very fortunate that our portfolio is turning out to be resilient. We have no hotel exposure globally. So that sort of has been one of the other notable as a part of our portfolio composition. Mm-hmm. But logistics, you know, has played an increasingly role in bigger role in Allianz real estate. And we're trying to be investing a lot more into logistics in Asia Pacific, Europe, and the US. But in Asia Pacific, I had the benefit of starting late. And in 2016, when we started, you know, logistics was one of the highest conviction themes for us. And what we like about logistics is, you know, whether it's sort of earlier, it was a lot about industrialization. So you needed sort of warehouses, but with sort of ability to have industrial operations running out of those warehouses. That has slowly changed with more e-commerce penetration in most of the markets. And Asia Pacific particularly has seen faster adoption of e-commerce than a lot of the other parts of the world, which has helped increase the demand of a B2C business. And the crisis has also taught us that adoption of e-commerce and technology is not the most difficult thing in the world. You know, it is interesting that the expansion, the consumer base or the user base of e-commerce has expanded exponentially. And there is an increase in spend per user. And people are buying things that they would have never bought online. For example, I myself bought a treadmill online and got delivered, is working fine, and I really like it. But before the crisis, I would have never imagined buying a treadmill online or certain other things that we've been buying online. You know, so my father, who did not like using e-commerce tools because he thought someone would steal money from his credit card, is now one of the most prolific users of e-commerce. So I think, you know, this has changed behaviors of people, and e-commerce is likely to play a bigger role in the future. And so, look, I think you still have to be careful about investment. You can't blindly go and buy every warehouse that comes up for sale. I think for logistics, it's important what kind of specifications does the warehouse have, because, you know, it needs to cater to modern logistics specification and ensure that, for example, you are able to deploy AI in these logistics facilities, which is increasingly becoming common. You have to make sure that the micro location of the logistics facility has a big appropriate catchment area and is easily accessible. You also have to spend a lot of time on the tenant base, whether it's a B2C or a B2B, and what does that mean in terms of long-term stickiness of the tenant. You have to better understand the credit of the tenant. So I think there are multiple things go behind it, but logistics from a macro perspective is still one of our high conviction sectors, especially in the Asia Pacific region. And that is why you heard that we announced the Aldi distribution center deal in Australia a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. Saw that deal. And you've also begun investing in India. And obviously there's probably a fairly small number of pretty big global investors who've gone into India real estate. So tell us a little bit about what's driven that for Allianz, and which markets and which sectors appeal the most there. And also a little bit about what the unique risks are for India.
Yeah, look, India is a large market, and from a macro perspective, it ticks the box on every requirement, whether it's the rise of the middle class or the demographic profile of the country, or whether it's the rising infrastructure spend and domestic consumption spend, and the adoption of technology. So all the boxes are ticked when it comes to macro fundamentals for India. However, the question is whether the systems and the infrastructure and the regulatory framework provides agility to businesses or not. And I think India, there has been a perception that, you know, things can get stuck and there are infrastructure and regulatory roadblocks which can hamper businesses in India. The situation has significantly improved over the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years. And now it is sort of getting on par globally with global standards. However, you know, we have to keep in mind it's a country of 1.3 billion people. Mm-hmm. And so there will be challenges and roadblocks. However, when you're investing, you have to just ensure that the returns you're getting, it compensates for the risk you're taking in. So if the risk is, the perceived risk is higher in India, the return expectation will be higher. And that has been the case. And that has led a lot of investors to go to the value-added and opportunistic side and not going to the core side. But I do see that in the long term, India will become a very large core market for investments. Today, we like the office story and the logistics story in India. And we have invested in three ventures across these two sectors. And we would look for more risk-adjusted opportunities in this market because we do believe that long-term, this will be one of the large core markets. And I think it has done well in the near term to get the industry institutionalized. And I think Apria has played a role, and having a REIT in India has played a big mm-hmm. role in institutionalization of this on the real estate industry. But look, I think it's, like I said, it ticks all the boxes on the macro side. And if you can figure out a way to navigate through the infrastructure and regulatory challenges and get comfortable with it, I think it is one of the better places to invest.
Okay. Now, something else that's a big investment for Allianz globally, but not thus far in this region, is real estate debt. Can you tell us a bit about why it's so important to Allianz, and also what the prospects are for your investment in this sector in Asia Pacific.
Sure. Debt investments is a big part of our business. We have 20 billion plus of exposure to real estate debt, and this is as you pointed out, is in Europe and US. And you know what debt provides us is long-term investments. You know, typically the kind of debt investments we do in Europe and US are loans with long-term tenors, and a lot of it is fixed-term loans as well. So it gives us a certainty of cash flow over a long period, and which is sort of is an important thing for an insurance company to have that visibility to cash flows over a long period of time. And that's why debt is an attractive investment asset class for Allianz. I think we would love to do more debt in Asia or venture into the debt side in Asia. However, when we invest, we look at scalable investment opportunities. And when you look at the Asia Pacific market with the purpose of investing on the debt side, the banks are flushed with cash, and there's a lot of sort of money available for people to borrow from the banks, and so it's a highly competitive environment in Asia Pacific on the real estate lending side. Also, in certain countries, you have to get comfortable with the legal and regulatory rules around foreclosure and restructuring and workouts, and so it's something that one needs to get comfortable with. However, you know, I think it is starting out to be a sector or a segment that we would be interested in. I think Australia stands out from a lending perspective. I think it has the most opportunities to do senior long-term debt investments. And I think that's something that we constantly evaluate. But I think, again, this crisis, again, brings an opportunity to relook at debt investments in the region, presumably starting with Australia.
And is the lack of, or the relative lack of longer-term loan opportunities in Asia Pac a factor, that timescales tend to be a bit shorter here with regards to things like lease lengths?
You're right. I think, you know, there are two things. One is traditionally, and this has changed in the last few years, but traditionally Asia Pacific was viewed as a value add opportunistic play. And so when you have a value add opportunistic play, the hold periods are generally 3 to 5 years. So that isn't, borrowers are not holding the asset long enough. That has changed. Now, Asia Pacific has increasingly become a core play, which now gives an opportunity for long-term investment. But as you pointed out, apart from Australia, and maybe a little bit in India, most of the lease terms are 2 to 5 years. So I think, you know, then it sort of becomes challenging to long-term investment or debt investments, because you don't have that whale supporting your loan. So I think Australia, that is the reason, stands out, because it is known to have long lease tenures. However, you know, as long as you can underwrite the risk, the tenancy risk, there may be opportunity to do even debt investments in markets where the lease terms are not necessarily long term, but it's still 3 to 5 years, which is healthy. And one just has to get comfortable with the credit and the fact that if things don't work out, there is a path to recover your principal and your interest.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is the real estate debt business that comes under the Allianz real estate business? Because obviously some organizations have it as part of their fixed income section. How is it for Allianz?
Yeah, for Allianz, you know, any direct real estate debt investments. So if there is a borrower or real estate owner, landlord who wants to borrow money on a direct one-to-one basis, you know, it is managed by Allianz Real Estate. However, if there is a debt fund that someone is operating, and if Allianz wants to invest in that fund, that can be done by us as well if there is an opportunity that we originate. However, I think most of our focus is on direct real estate debt investments versus sort of investing through debt funds.
Okay, fantastic. So we've had a kind of a good chat around a little bit of your history about Allianz's business in Asian real estate, about some of the sectors that that you've invested in India and logistics, and a little bit about the potential future for the real estate debt business here. So I'm going to round off with a final question, which is, I guess, more about you than about Allianz. So outside of your day-to-day concerns of the job and your ambitions for the business here, outside of that, what problem would you be personally most interested in solving or contributing to?
You know, I think I would be trying to accurately guess what my two-year-old has drawn on her blackboard. And I've been trying every day unsuccessfully, okay? Now that I spend a lot of time at home, so I get to... And she throws all these questions at me, and I've become better, but I'm not there yet. So I think that's my goal, that before this lockdown finishes, I've got to be able to correctly guess what she's drawing on the blackboard. But look, I think I'm a fairly straightforward person. I'm happy if I can help someone to be more successful than they think they can be. And this is the advice I started with my career with. And so if I can help anybody to be more successful than they think they unleash their potential, I think that sort of makes me happy. And whether it's a business or a person, I think that sort of is always my goal.
Great. Fantastic. Thanks very much indeed, Rush. Been great to speak to you.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me. And it's always a pleasure talking to you, Mark.
Thank you for tuning into the Apria Leadership Podcast Series. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. We will be back soon with more episodes featuring industry leaders and dealmakers who specialize in cross-border transactions across Asia Pacific. If you like what you've heard and would like to give us feedback on future podcast episodes, please contact Sigrid Zialcita at sigrid.zialcita@apria.asia for more information. Please check www.apriaasia or follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter @apriaasia to get the latest updates.